would encourage you to do so, though, because it really details the case in its entirety and the findings. And it's likely that most of the answers to your questions can be found by simply reading the report. It's also important to say that my comments are not intended to add to the report. The report is the action of the committee, and it speaks for itself. For several reasons, this case is among the most extraordinary in the history of the NCAA and the Committee on Infractions. It is extraordinary in the size and scope of the record and overall number of violations and individuals involved, the significant length of time it took to investigate the case, and the unfortunate public attention it received during that time, and the inappropriate conduct by the NCAA staff to gather information, which was ultimately determined to be improper and resulted in the exclusion of information from the record. It also required a procedure to enable all the parties to raise concerns over the matter. As everyone should know, the Committee on Infractions had nothing to do with the investigation, the way it was conducted, commissioning of the Cadwalader report, or the decision to exclude evidence improperly obtained. Those were the actions taken and decisions made by the NCAA staff. The committee acts on behalf of the Division I membership, which passes the rules in order to ensure fair competition and operational integrity. As is always the case, the committee's role is limited to processing the case following the issuance of a notice of allegations to a member institution. We have a hearing, consider the information presented to determine the facts, then apply those facts to the bylaws and determine whether violations occurred. If so, we consider penalties. That is what the committee does and did with this case that came before us in June. As I said, the volume in this case was enormous. There were 18 allegations with 79 issues and over 100 interviews of 81 individuals. There were thousands of pages of transcripts, supporting documents, and photographs, which were reviewed by the committee. It's important to note that the case record did not include the information that was improperly gathered and excluded, which the committee never saw. Most of the case focused on the activity of a booster that was afforded significant access to the student-athletes and coaches in the football and men's basketball programs as a result of his donor status at the university. It was actually through this donor program that he was initially introduced to student-athletes on the football team. The booster's impermissible involvement was pervasive. He committed many violations with numerous student athletes over a very long period of time. He entertained them in his home, on his yacht, at restaurants, at nightclubs, and at a local bowling alley. He engaged the services of others, including a former equipment manager, to entertain student athletes. He provided numerous gifts to student athletes, including a significant amount of cash to influence the student athletes' pro potential, to sign with a sports agency of which he was a part owner. He was also involved in violations with football and men's basketball coaches. He developed relationships with them, provided them with cash and loans, and assisted them in the recruitment of high-profile prospects. The involvement of the coaches in these violations was troubling for many reasons, as they were not only aware of the violations, but participated in them, and in some cases provided false and misleading information when asked about them. As it relates to the former head men's basketball coach, as with all head coaches, he clearly had a responsibility to promote an atmosphere of compliance within his program and take demonstrative steps to ensure the program was operating in compliance, which includes an obligation to monitor. Although the allegations against the former head coach were limited to a failure to promote an atmosphere of compliance, the report details various facts which support the committee's conclusion that he failed in this responsibility. It is very important to note that the committee did not rely solely on the statements of the booster, who was in fact a convicted felon who provided much of the information while in prison. The vast majority of the statements made by the booster were corroborated by statements of others, as well as independent documentation. Moreover, the institution and its counsel were in agreement that most of the violations occurred, as alleged. As it relates to the institution, the committee greatly appreciates the patience of its administrators, as well as the level of cooperation that exhibited throughout the investigation and processing of the case, notwithstanding its extraordinary nature. Enforcement staff has a responsibility not only to the involved member institution, but to all Division I members to conduct its investigation thoroughly, properly, timely, and without overreaching. assessing whether a member lacks institutional control, the committee considers whether adequate compliance measures exist, whether those measures were appropriately conveyed to those who need to be aware of them, whether they are monitored to ensure they are followed, and whether the member appropriately acts when learning of potential violations of them. In this case, the committee determined that adequate compliance measures did not exist at the institution, weren't effectively conveyed or effectively monitored, which contributed to the violations going unreported and undetected for several years. Regarding penalties, however, the committee noted and accepted the significant penalties imposed, the institution imposed on its football program, which included postseason bowl and ACC championship competition for both the 2011 and 2012 season. These penalties were severe, and the unprecedented actions by the university was taken into account by the committee. The institution imposed other penalties and corrective actions as well, which are detailed in the report. In addition, the committee imposed scholarship reductions in both football and men's basketball for a 3-year period to coincide with the length of probation, as well as requiring some reformative activity on behalf of the university in the form of audits and other compliance activities. The penalties affecting the individual coaches in this case are severe. They include a 2-year show cause order for each of the coaches found to have acted unethically and a 5-game suspension for the former head men's basketball coach. Our hope is that this frustrating and disappointing chapter for the institution and the NCAA can be one more step closer to being closed, and that all of those impacted can now move forward. Emily, with that, I'll kick it back to you and see what questions folks may have.
Thank you, Brittany. Operator, can you please explain how reporters can indicate how they would like to ask a question?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen on the phone lines, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. You will hear a tone indicating you've been placed in queue, and you may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, if you do have a question, please press star, then 1 at this time. And one moment for the first question. And our first question comes from the line of Dennis Dodd with CBSSports.com. Please go ahead.
Britton, can you hear me okay?
You can, Dennis.
Okay. Did the committee in any way take into consideration how this case was handled previously, some of the stuff the NCAA admitted, in deciding the penalty?
Not with respect to deciding the penalty. As I mentioned, our role from the COI perspective is limited to hearing the case as presented and making findings. With that said, I know the COI was disappointed to learn of the use of the bankruptcy proceeding to obtain information to be used in the case, to also force a process to ensure that the parties had the opportunity to raise concerns over it, but it certainly didn't factor into the film.
Right. And also, if I could follow up, and I haven't read the whole report yet, but how much blame should the former athletic director get in this, given that the infractions report itself says this is going on for a decade?
I mean, obviously, all institutional administrators share responsibility for ensuring compliance with the rules. And so, you know, I'm sure some of that responsibility is shared by the, you know, the athletic leaders that want to employ the time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Michael DeCursey with Sporting News. Please go ahead.
Britton, I wanted to ask you about the use of scholarship penalty, something that the NCAA has done for a very long time. And I wondered if, in doing so, you guys are cognizant or considering at all the fact that you're essentially destroying free educations for young people, and you're representing an organization that gets a huge tax break by claiming it's an educational organization. According to my calculations, you wiped out 12 scholarships in the two sports, which at the University of Miami rate of $57,000 plus a year is worth nearly $700,000. And I wonder why the Committee on Infractions continues to use this practice, given what it entails?
You know, it's in the legislation. The membership passes the legislation and suggests what appropriate penalties are and are not. And in this case, it's in the legislation. And again, like I said earlier, you know, our responsibility is individual membership.
And our next question comes from the line of Pat Forte with Yahoo Sports. Please go ahead.
Hi, Britton. That was a long delay getting on the call, so you may have addressed this in your opening remarks, but I'm curious. This was a very long deliberation from the time of the Committee on Infractions hearing to the ruling. What went into the length of time that it took to render a ruling?
Yeah, typically we're able to turn around reports in a 6 to 8 week period of time, which is what we hope to do. Unfortunately, the case not only lasted 3+ years in the investigation stage, but also had a lot of complexities to it that were extraordinary. The pre-hearing process was extraordinary. The sheer volume of the case was enormous. And so, you know, our first responsibility is to do the best we can to understand the case record and to get it right. And we like to do it in a rapid way as well, but that's not always possible.
And our next question comes from the line of Brian London with FM 104.3, The Ticket.
Yes, sir. Just wondering, you know, recently the NCAA has been punishing people involved rather than the institutions on a higher level. Just wondering how that came into effect with the assistants and former coaches in this scenario.
Good question. You know, allocating responsibility between the institution and the individuals involved is something that is important to the committee, and I think important to the Division I membership. Institutions need to feel comfortable that if they're doing everything they possibly can, and we have individuals that are involved in bad action, that they can somehow not be included in a global responsibility for that. In this case, there were multiple individuals penalized. Individuals penalized from a show cause standpoint. We have an individual that was penalized with a game suspension. So we did lay a lot of responsibility onto the individual in the case. And, you know, I think it's going to be a subject of ongoing discussion among the Division I membership how to appropriately allocate responsibility.
Question comes from the line of Linda Robertson with Miami Herald.
I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on when you're talking about the complexities of the case and the fact that the NCAA had, you know, some flawed investigative procedures. How did that factor into the committee and infractions decision on the penalties?
Like I said before, we didn't factor it in. I mean, what we once the notice of allegations was issued, I guess, in February, it was complex because we had to come up with a process to ensure that information improperly gathered was not included in the case record and certainly wouldn't be included among the information that we consider when deliberating on a case. And so we did that. Actually, the case has an appendix to it, Appendix 1, that is very detailed in terms of what that process. So that process was very complex and challenging, and it's really extraordinary, in my experience at least, to have a process like that. But nevertheless, once we got the facts in front of us, once we, you know, did our work understanding what facts we were going to find, what the basis was for those findings, we didn't consider the staff's misconduct.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Brandon O'Doyle with KingInsider.com. Please go ahead.
Yes, I was just curious, and maybe you addressed this in your opening comments. It took a while for us to get connected. Was your address, and is there any way to know, since the fact that Miami already self-imposed significant penalties, what you would have recommended as far as sanctions were concerned had they not done so?
With what we felt like were some significant significant self-imposed penalties. So we really didn't have to ask ourselves, what if that didn't happen, what would we do? It really wasn't ever a top of the conversation.
And our next question comes from the line of Ivan Michel with ESPN.com. Please go ahead.
Hi, Britton. Can you explain the difference in a case where a school that has similar penalties or similar violations gets 10 scholarships a year and that this one is 3 scholarships a year?
Well, I mean, as you know, each case is unique, and no doubt, you know, folks will have a difference of opinion whether the penalties were too severe or too light, depending on your perspective. We don't put cases up against each other because of the unique nature of each case. I mean, in this particular case, we felt like the institutional self-imposed penalties were absolutely significant, unprecedented, really. And also the level of cooperation in this case was commendable. And so, you know, those are factors that weighed into the committee's thinking, and but we don't do a great deal of comparative analysis given the unique nature of the case.
Is it a standard operating procedure that you do not say, well, we did this in this case, therefore that's our starting point?
I mean, each case stands on its own and has a different set of facts and circumstances associated with it. And you know, each committee is a different group of people in some cases. Certainly, if you consider the 50-plus years that the committee has been in existence.
And our next question comes from the line of Dan Walken with USA Today. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Britton, there's a portion of the report in which the former men's basketball coach was found to have given two different accounts of an event. How much latitude does the committee give somebody to essentially change their story?
You know, that's a great question. You know, frankly, it was difficult, I think, for the committee and maybe even the members of the enforcement staff to know precisely what really was going on with the basketball program, given all of the conflicting information that was kind of in the record. We felt like we had a responsibility to review that and to publish it, just because it was information that we felt like ultimately required to draw some conclusions. But I can tell you he was only charged with failure to promote an atmosphere of compliance, which is this responsibility every coach has and requires them to, with not only their words but their actions, strongly encourage the rules of compliance. And so we were able to determine, I think, that we did not meet that responsibility. I think there's clearly support in the factual narrative with that in terms of the failure from other aspects of compliance.
And our next question comes from the line of Susan Miller Bagnon with Miami Herald. Please go ahead.
Sarah, I think Ivan kind of asked what I was going to ask about the, you know, considering what some other schools have gotten in terms of scholarship sanctions, you know, if you expected some negative feedback from those schools. That was the first part. And then I also, I know I missed also the beginning of the call. I couldn't get on. But you keep talking about the significant self-imposed penalties. I wanted to know exactly what is significant, and I'm assuming you mean the bowl ban or anything else, and also how much did it contribute to being significant that UM also happened to miss the ACC title game?
Well, I think what the self-imposed penalties represented was an indication by the university that it was taking the case very seriously. It understood that it needed to respond internally to the situation and for the university to step up during the pendency of the investigation based upon the information that they had developed. To impose these bowl bans is a big deal. very big deal. The fact that it also prevented an ACC competition, the championship game, which essentially could have led to a BCS bowl berth. I mean, those are very big decisions that were made by the university, and the committee appreciated those decisions, and it's reflected, I think, in our report.
And currently, there are no further questions in queue. Please continue.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes our comments. A recording of this teleconference will be available in the near future on ncaa.org. We apologize for the delay for some of you getting on the call.